Outskirts Science Fiction Theater on Avid Reader Nation. It is reported there are about 46 million Americans living below the poverty line, yet Paul LaJoy writes that it is impossible to be poor in this country. Read his book and you will know why he makes this bold and outrageous statement. He knows better. He was born in a poor village in Africa. It is impossible to be poor in America. Get this book by Paul LaJoy at www.lajoysolutions.com and amazon.com. Hello, I am Deidre Huey, the eroticist, La Drama Princess, and science fiction enthusiast. The main theme on Outskirts Science Fiction Theater is science fiction, which sometimes wanders into fantasy, historical, horror, and other mixes in the speculative fiction genre. Each week, I present authors who read from their excerpts and offer an entry into their motivations and backstories of their works of fiction. Tonight on Outskirts Science Fiction Theater, Debbie Mamber-Kupfer is our reading guest. Hello, Debbie.
Hello. Hi, Deidre. Thanks for having me on your show.
Oh, you're so welcome. Well, what do you have for us tonight to read?
I have my story, Griddlebone, which is from the anthology Sins of the Past, which is a collection of historical horror stories. Each based in a different historic period. My story, Griddlebone, takes place in the Second World War in Vienna.
Okay.
Okay.
All righty. Well, here's how it works. You have 15 to 30 minutes to read your excerpt, and while you're reading, my mic will be muted, but I am still here listening, so don't fear. I'm not going anywhere. So are you ready?
I am ready.
Okay, and once you're done, we're going to have a little chit-chat. And, yeah, so you can get started right now.
Okay. Griddlebone by Debbie Mamber-Kupfer. The werecat padded silently across the cobbles of the dark Vienna street. It was deserted now, but Griddlebone knew it would soon be filled with bootsteps and cries, gunshots and blood. They were slated to come at dawn to cleanse this last Jewish neighborhood of its vermin so that the proper folk of Vienna could finally live judenfrei. Inside the darkened houses, the residents huddled in fear. The news of the transport had only come hours before, and some still couldn't believe it. They had been fooling themselves for months, believing that one insignificant street could survive in its own little bubble, that somehow God would protect them. They readied themselves with what few valuables they had left. Maybe they could still bribe the Nazi soldiers. Maybe there was still a way out. The werecat flexed his claws as he waited in the shadows. Griddlebone wished he could rescue them all, but his orders were clear. He could take only one. They needed to be the right age, too. A teenager would be good, strong enough to fight, strong enough to survive the turning. As the first rays of light caught the cobblestones, Griddlebone felt the footsteps echoing down the street. Soon, his tail swished back and forth in anticipation. Within minutes, the first soldier came into view. The werecat was all but invisible. To the soldiers, his mottled grey coat blending perfectly with the cold grey street. At the same time as the soldiers appeared on foot, a silver-grey truck arrived on the street and parked in front of the buildings, waiting for its human cargo. As the Gestapo soldiers marched past the werecat's hiding place, he clawed, longed to dig his claws into their ankles to hear them scream with pain. Not yet, Griddlebone. Not yet. The soldiers reached the first house. They banged on the doors. Juden, heraus, heraus, schnell, schnell. Everybody out of there. Quickly, quickly. At first there was silence. Griddlebone held his breath, waiting. And then slowly they came out. squinting in the light of the dawn. They'd been inside for so long, sitting in the darkness. They looked like ancient patriarchs held in suspended animation from biblical times. The man had a long white beard and was wearing a prayer shawl. The woman had her head covered and bent. She held out something to the soldiers. The werecat stole closer to take a better look. It was a silver candlestick. The frightened woman offered it to the soldier. The soldier laughed. He grabbed it and shoved it in his bag, then roughly pulled the old woman forward. She tripped and fell on the hard cobble street. The soldier kicked her and she cried out in pain. Throughout this, her husband was bobbing up and down in prayer, praying that God would take them before these Nazis did. His prayers were not answered, and the soldiers forced the old couple into the waiting truck. More soldiers had arrived now and pushed their way into the buildings. The next house held a young family, a mother and a father with two small, terrified children. The mother clutched a baby girl in her arms, and as they boarded the truck, the baby started crying. The nearest soldier grabbed her from her mother's arms and flung her with full force into the solid concrete wall. The baby stopped crying. The mother screamed. A Nazi scolder silenced the mother with his gun. The father and his remaining children climbed quickly into the truck, trying not to look back. The werecat stalked over to the baby. He nudged her gently with his nose, but it was too late. In any case, how would his clan have been able to care for a baby? They could barely find enough food for their own kittens these days. Griddlebone continued watching the parade of Jews being evicted from their buildings. They had been told they were being rehoused, that their homes were needed for the war effort. As patriotic Austrians, surely they understood. Griddlebone knew that most of these Jews would end up in the concentration camps, if they even survived the transport. A second shot filled the air, a young man this time. He had tried to run, but the soldiers had used him for target practice. Still, the werecat watched and waited. There she was, struggling at the back of another family, the girl he had been watching for the last few weeks. She looked around with wary eyes and caught sight of the cat on the corner of the street. The cat had been her friend. She would sneak out and give him scraps to eat from her own meager portion. Now the cat was watching her with big orange eyes. It was strange. She wasn't scared, despite the soldiers and the guns and the screaming. Of all those here, she thought, looking around at the collection of frightened Jews, she felt she had the best chance of surviving. She held her head upright and stared straight into the eyes of the Nazi soldiers. Yes, thought Griddlebone, watching her. I've chosen rightly. Esther is strong, a survivor. Silently, Griddlebone sent his message to the rest of the clan members who were waiting in the shadows. They moved into previously agreed positions on the street corners. They readied themselves to pounce. Each cat started out as an insignificant street cat, but slowly they began changing and growing into wildcats that resembled tigers more than tabbies. On Griddlebone's signal, they launched themselves onto the Nazi soldiers, ripping at them with fearsome tears, teeth and claws. The soldiers shrieked in fear and fired at the cats, but the felines were far swifter than any of the men. They dodged the bullets with ease, dancing around them, taunting their enemies with their agility. Within just a few minutes, two soldiers had fallen to the werecats. The remaining cut their losses and quickly shoved the terrified Jews into the transport. They jumped onto the truck and fled. While the werecats attacked the soldiers, Griddlebone beckoned to the girl. Instinctively, she followed him into the shadows and ran after him through the streets until the howling and screaming was far behind them. Finally, they arrived at an old warehouse. Griddlebone stopped at the door and nudged it with his nose. It creaked open, and the two of them walked in. The room was filled with yowls and growls and laughter. It was a strange mix that met Esther's eyes. There were many different cats. Some, she supposed, were werecats like Griddlebone, but amongst the cats were humans, mostly children about her age. They were sitting in groups playing cards games or chess, or others were just talking. She turned to the old cat. "Where are we?" she asked. "Headquarters," he said, his voice echoing in her head. "It isn't much, but it's our home." "What about my family?" asked Esther. "My friends?" "I'm sorry," said Griddlebone. "The Nazis have taken them to the transport. There's nothing we could do. I would love to save everyone, but we cannot. We are lucky if we rescue one person from each transport." "Where will they take them?" she asked. "To the ghetto. But there are rumors that they don't stay very long. The Nazis have set up concentration camps, and most that enter those never leave." "Just for the Jews," said Esther. "Mostly, but not all. Also the gypsies, the communists, the homosexuals, anyone that Hitler does not deem to be pure." "And we can't do anything?" "We do what we can. Everyone here has lost family." "Everyone?" asked Esther, looking at the mix of animals and humans in the room. "Everyone," answered Griddlebone. "I was the first, an early experiment. The Germans, seeking a better soldier, a better fighting machine, hired a scientist to help them with their work. He was considered a revolutionary in the field of genetics. In his laboratory, he created mutants by blending feline genes with human. He chose the cat because it was the easiest carnivore to obtain. It was simple to take an alley cat off the street. No one missed it, except the other cats, of course, but who cares about those? They wanted a predator, one that they could teach to kill for them, one that their enemies wouldn't expect. But cats are fickle creatures and intelligent, too. I woke up in that laboratory, outwardly appearing as I had been, a young man of 20. But inwardly, I could feel the change that had been wrought, could feel the new feline essence inside me. The scientists wanted a demonstration to show the Gestapo chief who was visiting that day. Yes, I decided, I would give him a demonstration. The Gestapo chief paced in front of me. "You say he can change?" "Yes, sir." He turned to me, smiling. "So let's see it, Herr Griddlebone." I concentrated, understanding instinctively what to do. Inside me, I retained the memory of the old street cat that had been used in my creation. My body contracted, and I became a presumably harmless house cat, a large grey tabby. "Marvelous," said the Gestapo chief, clapping his hands. "You'll make a wonderful spy, but maybe not such a good fighter. You are working on others, I suppose. Vienna Zoo is at your service. Take whatever you need from there. I fancy perhaps a lion or a leopard or a tiger." "Oh," I thought, "a tiger's what you want. I might be able to do something about that." As soon as the Nazi's back was turned, I pounced. In the air, my body changed, quickly growing 10 times my original size. My claws lengthened and sharpened into dangerous weapons, and my teeth became vicious canines. "That's for my mother and father," I bellowed, and I sunk my teeth into the Gestapo chief's flesh. The rest of the Nazis in the room were cowards. They ran from me, screaming, and I had no difficulty getting out of the laboratory. Once outside, I shrunk back down into regular cat size, my favorite form from then on, and ran out into the streets of Vienna. I had no clear idea what to do or where to go. My family had been killed on the day I was taken, but the Nazis had given me a gift. In my cat form, I could easily blend into the shadows. Nobody suspected a cat, after all. My attack on the Gestapo chief did not deter the Nazis from their experiments. If anything, it empowered them. If one small cat could create such chaos, what could a whole army of shape-shifting carnivores achieve? I was making friends with the street cats, but sometimes my friends would go missing, just as they had when I'd lived as a Jew. Some of the street animals were taken for food by ordinary citizens. The war years had led to shortages of meat. But others were taken by the Nazis so they could continue their experiments. My first rescue was a glorious thing. I meowed at the door of the laboratory, making myself smaller and inconsequential. A lab assistant let me in, smirking. Well, we could always do with another cat. Although this one doesn't look like he has a lot of fight in him. Little did they know. Around the room were a number of cages. Some contained cats yet to be used in the experiments. Others contained the results of previous experiments. Strange, were-creatures, cats of all shapes and sizes, some grotesquely disfigured as the scientists tried to improve his mutations. The lab assistant saw me as no threat, just a street moggy. So he gave me a sort of milk and left me loose on the floor of the lab. Needs a little fattening up before we can use him, one of them said. I lapped my milk and waited for my opportunity. I wandered around the room, sniffing hither and thither, pretending to explore. But actually, I was picking the locks with my mind. When the scientist made me, he truly didn't understand the power he was unleashing. The addition of feline genes to my genetic makeup gave me powers I could never have dreamed of before. Telepathy, of course, for that is how I'm speaking with you now, and also a limited telekinesis. The locks were easy to pick. I merely had to visualize the mechanism inside, and they simply slipped open. I prepared the residents for escape, reaching out to each mind with my whiskers. All could help free themselves, I explained, the werecats and the true cats. Everyone had claws and teeth after all. On that day, we killed 5 men in the Nazi laboratory, all but the scientist. The scientist begged for his life, and we considered this and decided to be lenient. He could be useful, so we spared his life and brought him with us. We wondered if we could trust him, of course, but he seemed to prefer to be on the winning side. Come, let us meet him, said Griddlebone. He led Esther across the main room and into a small one directly opposite. A white-haired man sat at a table drinking a cup of coffee and reading a newspaper. He looked up as the two of them entered. Ah, Griddlebone, you have returned. Good, sehr gut. And this is our new recruit? Yes, Herr Wäschler. The scientist sized up Esther with critical eyes, and she understands the dangers. She has been informed. Herr Wäschler sighed. We have lost too many, he said, and still Hitler continues transporting more to the camps. That is why, Herr Wäschler, said Griddlebone, why we have to keep trying, keep recruiting. Do we have a volunteer? Asked Wäschler quietly. Yes, there are many cats waiting to join our ranks. So be it. Let me finish my coffee and we will begin. Esther ran through the streets of Vienna. It had been raining and the cobbles felt slick beneath her paws. It was the first time she had been outside of headquarters since her transformation. Griddlebone hadn't really wanted her to go out yet on her own, but she had slipped out in the early hours of that morning. She was restless and wanted to explore in her new feline form. Having been in hiding for so long, it felt amazing to be free, to be out on the street, to feel the wind ruffle her fur. She was drawn to visit her old street, but it was deserted now, abandoned. The soldiers had taken everyone but her to the transport, and their homes had been ransacked. She looked for something worth saving, but there was nothing. Maybe it was better that way. She would not have been able to take anything but the smallest memento back with her anyway. She walked more slowly back to the warehouse, subdued by her visit to her home, which was no longer a home. She thought about her family and friends that had been taken. Griddlebone talked of raids, grand rescues from concentration camps. Esther was anxious to join those rescue parties. The guard walked around the perimeter of the fence for the third time that night. He could swear he saw eyes staring at him. within the depths of the forest that surrounded the concentration camp. But wherever he went to get a closer look, the yellow eyes blinked out and shifted to another part of the forest. He thought he could hear a persistent hissing, too. Snakes, maybe? Forest have snakes? The guard shuddered. It was frigid cold that night, and he longed for his shift to be over, so he could go inside the soldiers' barracks and warm himself by the fire. The inmates of the concentration camp had no such luxury as a fire. They shivered in their raggedly cotton pajamas. Arbeit macht frei. Those words were on the front of the great gates of the concentration camp. But the inmates understood that it was not work that made you free, it was death. Death was the only escape from those gates. Or at least that is what they believed. Griddlebone stood at the edge of the forest with Esther. They had traced Esther's father to this place. There were probably others she knew from Vienna behind these gates, but the young werecat understood they wouldn't be able to rescue them all. She also had been made to understand the danger. In every such raid, they lost werecats. It was the risk they took. Esther watched the guard circle by the gate for the third time. Swiftly, she moved forward, pushed herself through the iron bars, and walked up to the guard. She tried to make herself look as small and pathetic as possible. "Ketzel, little cat," said the guard and bent down to pet her. "Where did you come from?" Esther looked up at the guard and gave a plaintive meow. "Are you hungry, Ketzel? Well, I've nearly finished my shift. If you stay with me, I'll take you back to the barracks. Maybe I can find you a few scraps." Esther purred. She was in. It was only a matter of time. Griddlebone waited for Esther's signal. He was tense, and the fur on his back was fluffed up. All around the perimeter of the camp, the werecats waited. They would be responsible for the distraction, the attack on the camp guards. He and Esther were going to attempt to rescue. Griddlebone flexed his claws. He was aching for a fight. He growled involuntarily. At midnight, there was a change of guard, and he watched Esther disappear into the barracks. "Please, God, let her be okay," he prayed. He had grown fond of the girl in the last few months. He had lost so much already. He couldn't bear to lose Esther as well. Inside the barracks, the guards fawned over the little cat. They gave her a saucer of milk and petted her. "But you'd better hide before the commandant sees her." "Why?" "But you better hide her before the commandant sees her." "Why?" "Don't you know? He hates cats." "Scared, more like. I heard his brother was killed by one." "Nonsense. She's harmless. It's just stories, that's all. I've heard he was a drunkard, that Gestapo officer. Those soldiers were just covering for him with the story of the cat." "Still, I would hide her." "Fair enough. Whatever you say. Here, kitty, come over here." They placed her saucer of milk in a storage cupboard along with a few scraps and ushered her inside. She mewed in confusion as they shut the door, continuing her act as a poor little kitten. Then, when she was sure they were no longer paying attention to her, she sent a message to Griddlebone through her whiskers. "I'm in," she said. Gradually, the voices of the soldiers petered off as one by one they went to sleep. Esther finished her meal and took a catnap while she waited. Outside the perimeter of the fence, the rest of the werecats closed in on the camp, each watching and waiting for a sign from Griddlebone. At dawn, the commandant rose from his special quarters and walked into the guards' barracks. Esther awoke instantly as he entered. Even through the closet door, she could smell him. He reeked of expensive cologne and arrogance. She bristled and sat motionless in the closet, listening carefully. The commandant greeted the soldiers gruffly. The soldiers had all but forgotten about the little cat in the closet. But the commandant could sense Esther's presence almost immediately. He walked around the room, sniffing the air, and then came to a stop directly in front of the closet door. "I suspect we have a rat he said, and reached for the handle of the door. Or else, a cat. As he opened the door, Esther darted out beneath his feet. Catch her quickly! Schnell, schnell! The guards rushed around, trying to reach the cat, but she was too quick and darted out into the compound, running towards the barracks that held the Jews. She screamed a message to Griddlebone as she ran and prayed the other cats would get there in time. At the doorway to the barracks, an inmate was looking out. Esther was horrified when she saw the skeleton-like man in front of her, wearing nothing but a flimsy cotton pajamas decorated with a yellow Star of David. "Ketzer," said the Jew, and he smiled. He liked cats. Back in Vienna, he had once owned a cat, a pretty little tabby with warm fur and a sweet meow. Esther gazed into the man's sunken eyes. She couldn't bear it anymore. Disobeying every lesson she had learnt from Griddlebone, she shifted her body back into human form and ran to the man. "Papa," she screamed, "we've come to save you." The man looked confused. "Esther? How is this possible?" All around them now there were growls and gunshots. Esther clung to her father and desperate to protect him. The commandant was marching towards them. "You," he screamed, pointing at Esther. "You're nothing but a child, a mere kitten." "That might be true," came a voice from behind the commandant, "but I'm not." With that, Griddlebone expanded and grew until he was 10 feet high. He extended his claws and pounced on the commandant with the full power of a raging saber-toothed tiger. He knocked the Nazi to the ground and sank his teeth into his chest. "Never underestimate a cat," said Griddlebone. The end. And that's it.
Dead wow. I'm here. Well, that was good. I like the way that ended.
Thank you.
I enjoyed the whole story. I was sitting here like, she deserves a round of applause.
Thank you.
I like what you did with that. I seriously do.
I seriously did like that.
So what? How did you come up with the name of this character, Griddlebone, and why did you decide to take this story in the direction you took?
Okay, well, Griddlebone is the name of a cat in T.S. Eliot's book, Possum Cats, in his cat's book. I can't think of the whole title at the moment, but it's a name of, it's mentioned in the poem The Cavity, which is one of my favorite poems, and he's just mentioned on the side as one of the other criminals that the McCavity, who's a mystery cat, is. And so I took the name from T.S. Eliot, and it seemed to fit this maverick character, cat character, a werecat character I had in the story. The story just came. I was invited by a friend of mine to join an anthology project called Sins of the Past. He had the idea that each person should take a historic period and write a horror story in that particular period. I am most familiar with the time period of the Second World War because my father grew up in Vienna till he was 6 years old, and then he left Vienna on the Kindertransport, which is children from Austria and Germany were rescued, and Czechoslovakia were rescued and brought to England when they were small, away from their parents, and rescued just before the war broke out in Europe. So that's how I'm most familiar with the area. The street that this starts on is the street my father actually grew up in, and I've been to the street to Rosa Spelgasse, which is where I'm visualizing in the beginning of the story. The area and the street also feature at the beginning of my novel, Pause. And Griddlebone, the character, is actually going to come back later in my series, in the third book that I'm writing of my series too. And I didn't plan it that way. It just kind of, as I'm writing, I realize that everything most what I write is interlocked together. So there we go. I don't know. Did I answer your question? I think so.
Yeah, you did. Yeah, that was a good answer. I just like the way that you took something like a typical topic and you put another spin on it with the werecats, because most people, they do werewolves. I don't see too many werecat stories. And I like the fact that he could be a big cat or a small cat.
And that's part of, that's his power, yeah. It's, I like cats. I like cat. Most things I write have some kind of cat thing in it. Virtually every story I've written has a cat in it. There's a few exceptions, but mostly it's cats.
So you're a cat lover.
I have
lover.
A cat, too. Yeah, I'm a cat lover. I'm definitely a cat lover.
I don't like cats, but that was a good story involving cats. But since I can imagine a cat being bad like that, you know, just because I don't like them. But I like what you did with that. And I know the certain people that are listening are greatly enjoying that as well. And the way that you turn that into science fiction and speculative fiction. And made it something totally different. So you said this was feeding into your Pause series. So can you tell us about that series?
Okay. Pause is a young adult fantasy with crossover appeal. A lot of adults have enjoyed Pause too. It's the story of Miri, who is a young Jewish girl, who, when she is 10 years old, receives a silver cat charm from her Omama, that's grandmother in German. And she doesn't know that the charm was what saved her Omama's life, also from the Nazis. This is the day before her Omama dies, and she's grown up just with her grandmother. She never knew her father or her mother. And now, all of a sudden, she's taken from her home, the only home she knows, by a relative, an aunt who she didn't even know exists before, and transplanted to St. Louis, which happens to be where I live too. And her aunt and uncle never really wanted children, so they ship her off to a boarding school. And at the boarding school, because she's different and, you know, comes from a poorer family and everything else, She's bullied. She's bullied big time at school. And one day, while she is being bullied, she gets chased into the back of the ground and up into a tree. And then the charm that she'd been wearing, that she'd been given by her grandmother, suddenly starts to work for the first time. And she discovers her magic. And by discovering her magic, She is later brought to the Pause Institute, which is the partnership of anime guy, werewolves and shapeshifters, or weres and shapeshifters, as we're going to discover in the third book, because were cats and were other creatures are part of it too. And, you know, her life gets a lot more complicated and a lot more interesting from that point. The book was put out by Rocking Horse Publishing, which is a small press here in St. Louis. Was published in 2013, and then last year in 2014, I published book two, Argentum, and I'm currently writing the third in the series.
Okay, so you say a lot of adults like this young adult fantasy series, Pause. What do they like about it the most? What do they tell you they like the most about it?
I think what they like is that even though it's YA only because some of the main characters are teens, but I also have quite a lot of adult characters that are not just side characters. They are you know, really features strongly in the book. And we have a lot of people like the background. I get into the history of how, you know, how the whole institute and how everything came about, and how we do have werewolves and how the werewolves. I've even in this third book now, I've gone into how the first werewolf was ever created, you know. So it's, I like doing that. I like going one step and explaining the magic, not just, well, it's just magic, it's just what it is. No, I go further, and that's what a lot of adults have taken out of it. So, you know, kids like the characters, and I have some fun characters too, but the adults tend to like the background and the history behind it.
Mm-hmm. And what did you say the name of the third book was again, since you mentioned you were giving more history on the record?
It still could change. It's currently called Maze of Shadows, but I haven't finished writing it yet, and it could change. I don't know. That's my working title of the third book. I don't know.
Do you have an idea when it might come out this year?
Well, this year, I would hope it will be out at the end of the year, probably around October or November, because that's when Argentum came out. So I would like a year between my books is probably how it's going to be.
Okay.
But before then, I have something coming out really, really soon. I have a puzzle book coming out. My other hat. Well, my other hat, when I'm not writing fiction, I write puzzles. And I write puzzles for magazines, mostly for Penny Press and Dell. And also, my puzzles have been on the wall of a cafe in Seattle, and they've also been on a mug from the Unemployed Philosophers League. But now, I'm putting out my own book of logic problems together with my son, Joey. It's called Pause for Logic, and it should be out sometime in the next month, I would think. I've got the proof copy of it right by my side here now. I'm going to making the last final proof stage changes here. So sometime within the next few weeks, Pause for Logic will be out. And I'm really excited for this, because this is my first time trying to self-publish anything. Up until now, I've always been published by outside places, outside publishers. This is all me and Joey, and even my daughter designed the cover on this, so it's all homegrown. So it's exciting.
Where can we get this book? Where can we get this?
You'll be able to get it on Amazon really soon.
Okay.
There'll be an Amazon link in, I don't know, couple of days, and from my website too, and also from CreateSpace directly. There'll be a number of places.
What's the name of the website?
My website for the puzzle book is Pause for Puzzles. For my writing, it's called Pause for Thought, and the address for that is my own name. If you do my name for that, for pause for thought, it's debbiemambercupfer.wordpress.com.
Okay.
And everything can be reached that way too. And if anybody wants some signed copies of either Sins of the Past or Pause and Argentum, I can do that through the website or from Amazon. Everything's available that way too. Or other things. So those are other things too, in Barnes & Noble and anywhere you can go to a book online.
Okay, so I was going to ask you, how did you get started doing the puzzles?
I've been solving puzzles all my life, and I was very lucky, very fortunate. I used to live on the East Coast in New York, and when I was there, I was extremely lucky to pick up almost like my dream job. I got a job as an editor at Penny Press of puzzle magazines, and I worked there, and I learned the business there. And when I left New York and came to St. Louis, because this is where my husband grew up. My husband's American. That's how I ended up in America. I started working for them freelance, and I've been a freelance puzzle writer now for 16, nearly 17 years.
Oh, wow.
And so that's how the puzzle started.
Oh, my God. So is there any other unique or creative stuff that you do?
Well, they're just when I'm not, apart from Pause and Sins of the Past, which, by the way, I'm the editor of Sins of the Past, not just the contributor. And I do recommend our anthology is beautiful. It's a wonderful anthology. There's so many incredible stories in there. So we need some more love for the Sins. But apart from that, I have had stories in a number of other anthologies. Some are charity anthologies like Darkly Never After and Winter Wishes, which have been put up by various groups on Facebook. Actually, three different groups on Facebook. I'm involved in the Dragon's Rocket Ship that put up Winter Wishes, which is one of the most fantastic groups on Facebook. It's all devoted to science fiction and fantasy and geeky stuff and everything. Come join us. It's a wonderful group.
Okay.
I'm also in two anthologies put together by fiction writers, and I know you've had some other fiction writer people on your show. And in a couple of anthologies put together by another Facebook group called Write on Nanos. So, yeah, there you go. I think that's it.
What is your favorite part of writing horrifying speculative fiction?
I'm kind of surprised by myself, you know, because I don't read horror, really. It's not my favorite genre at all. I read fantasy. I read science fiction. I read literary fiction. But I don't normally read horror. So I was kind of surprised that I like writing it, and I have kind of an evil mind, and I can do this. Not the only horror story I've written. I also wrote a story for Heroes and Villains, which is one of the anthologies of the Fiction Writers Group. I have a story in there called Alistair, which is about the main villain in Pause, who is a really, really, really evil werewolf. And I was surprised, even when I was writing Pause, how I could get into his head, how he can do these really diabolical things. And I enjoy writing it. And I really enjoy writing it. And I sometimes get scared of myself. Like, where's my mind? Where did I come up with these things? I mean, this dude eats people. He eats people. And he gains his power from eating people. And yet, he's in my head or something. I don't know. So, yeah, I enjoy that. I get a high from doing that, and I'm surprised. I'm kind of surprised at myself, you know?
And you said it was Alistair in Heroes and Villains.
Yes, in Heroes and Villains. I think somebody else read you a story from Heroes and Villains, wasn't it? Annette, I think, yes. Or someone did. Someone read you a story from that, too. Or Don definitely has a story. Yeah, Don has a story in it.
Yes.
Yeah, in Heroes and Villains. So I think so does T. Harvey has a story in Heroes and Villains as well. So a number of us are doing that. And you've got some more people from Sins of the Past coming on in the future. I think you've got Misha next week and Cleve on another week as well, I think.
Yes, I do.
Yeah. You guys have to listen in to Misha's story next week, but don't listen to it in the dark or anything like that. Please don't. It's really scary and really cool.
That's what they should definitely do, is listen to it in the dark. We want people to be afraid on this show.
my co producer of Sins of the Past, Chastity Nicole, who helped put together Sins of the Past, when she read Misha's story, she said like she couldn't go to movies for a while after that and things. It was like really, really, it really is that way. You have to really enjoy it. So.
Oh my God. Yeah, that's going to be next week.
Yeah.
So I received this question from a listener of the show. So are you ready to answer this one?
Yeah, sure. Sure.
Okay, they wanted to know, do you think including your work in anthologies could actually hurt an author?
No, I don't think so. I think it helps an author. It helps them a lot because it builds up your portfolio on Amazon. So, like, when if you just have your own book or two, and it takes a while to get a full novel out on there, it doesn't look like much. So if an agent or, you know, I don't know, a movie producer or whatever was looking at your stuff and seeing who you are, uh-huh. and they look on Amazon and you've got one thing or two things, it doesn't look like much. But because I'm involved in anthologies, it's, you know, it looks like I have a lot of publications, and I do, and I do. And also, uh-huh. by being in anthologies, I've met a lot, I've networked and worked with people and met a lot of people that I didn't know before I started this whole process. Because, you know, writing a book and book on your own is a very kind of lonely pursuit. It's not some way that you normally are in touch with lots of other people. But when you work on anthology, and certainly some of the ones I've been involved in, like Apocalypse, which was also a brainchild of Misha, and he'll probably talk more about that, and Sins, and again, are cooperative things where we work together, where we helped each other, and that way, you know, and we helped each other with our writing process and helped ourselves get better, become better writers, better editors. So, you know, I think it's all good. Being an anthologist is all good.
I think when you put it in that perspective where it's like a cooperative, because you say the people in the fiction writers group and then the Dragon Rocket Ship group, I think it is. Is it that? Mm-hmm. Is that the name of it? Okay,
yes.
That makes it more, like you said, a cooperative. So it's not like, because I've been approached to do anthologies, and what I didn't like about it was, and I know it's what a lot of people say they don't like about doing anthologies, is because you get random people coming at you saying, well, I want to put your work in an anthology. You don't know this person. Mm-hmm. You don't have any connection to them whatsoever. So I think that's mm-hmm. why a lot of people say they don't want to do it. But if you are in a group and it's people that you can trust and you're going to continually do this with them and build a relationship, it can be good. But if it's just mm-hmm. random, I can definitely see it being bad, because I would never do it with randoms. And then also with randoms like that, I've had people say, well, if you do the anthology, and I said, well, what do I get out of it? Because they didn't present mm-hmm. anything of a benefit to me, because they would say, mm-hmm. well, if you do the anthology, you don't get any money. Or mm-hmm. you would get like $25 up front, and then anything mm-hmm. that was made off of the anthology, the one person who was producing it or publishing it keeps all of the money. And that mm-hmm. kind of doesn't sit too well with a lot of people, because if they don't know each other, mm-hmm. you know, it kind of makes you feel like you're getting kind of ripped off. But if you're yeah. coming together in a group and you're saying, hey, we're going to do this together, this is going to be our plan, we're helping each other out, and then we're standing mm-hmm. together, mm-hmm. then I would could see it being a benefit, and I could see why you guys like to do it that way.
Mm-hmm. And my different anthologies, each of them money-wise have different things. As I said, I'm in several anthologies where the money is going to charity. I probably should actually, what I'm thinking, there's one to mention. One, for example, Shades of Fear is the one example of a story I wrote that isn't a story. It's actually a memoir, because I'm a cancer survivor, so I wrote about my fear of going through cancer treatment for that particular anthology, which was very therapeutic for me to write it down, because when I was going through it, I could never have written it down or even shared much with anybody about it. But uh-huh. then that anthology, which has actually done very well, is also making money for kids with cancer, both in research and treatment. So it's like giving back. So my story helps to give back to kids too. So I feel that's valuable on both sides. It was good for me to be able to put my story out there. It's also good to be able to get to contribute something, you know, ongoing. And we've been giving, I hear that the anthology has been donating something on the lands for about $100 a month to the charity, which is really good, you know?
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, also, what about, I know people have this problem with anthology too, so I just want to hear how you're going to address it. You know, how do you deal with the fact of, say, for instance, one person that somebody gets the anthology and they read the first story or two in it, and then they decide they don't like it, and your your contribution is like in the middle of the book, and they never
my
get
contribution.
To it.
My contribution in Sins is towards the end because as the editor, I decided to put them in chronological order in this book, in the book, and as mine's a later story, and Misha's one of the later stories, I'm hoping people get to our stories. If I'm reading an anthology, and I do read anthologies too, and I don't like a particular story, that doesn't usually stop me reading the whole anthology. It usually just makes me skip that story and go on. So I hope most people would do that too. You're not going to like everything, you know? And I know in every anthology there are stronger stories and weaker stories. But, you know, that's it. I will read. I like reading anthologies because it's like a little, I can read that along with other books. I can just read an occasional story here and there in between, you know? So, no, I know. That can be the case. And you definitely, with, there's no such thing as an anthology where every single story is going to be perfect and everybody's going to like every single story. Everybody has their own feelings, you know? But I don't know. It's kind of what you have to assume, right? I don't know.
Don't
have to answer
anymore. Question from the listener. But I just wanted to hear what you had to say about it because I know you guys, y'all do a lot of them. And that's exactly why they asked the question. But I know the reason why I say it because of my experiences with people, because there's never been a situation where I've been asked to be in an anthology and it was like the collaborative that you guys have. Never that way. It's always something that's scammy.
Right. I've never, you know, it's not, or I've been involved from the onset of the anthology. Like, we are going to put out, not something else I should say, we are, Misha's idea, so we're going to pick out a second Sins anthology. We're going to do Sins of the Future that's going to come out in next Halloween, in October of 2014. And so that's going to be more science fiction because there isn't any real future we can write about. It has to be, it all has to be speculative. But again, this is the group we all kind of know each other already from doing one anthology together. So we're continuing doing another one. I've never been asked by a completely outside person to do an anthology, but I have submitted to anthologies like where I'm going to get paid for. I'm going to be published in a Mars anthology, and I just, in that case, I saw the call for submissions. I wrote my story, I sent it to them, it was accepted, and it's going to be published in July or something. But that's a completely different story too. That's, you know. But I've never actually been approached in the way you said you've been approached. You know, that one I'm being paid for, and I'm going to get a whole bunch of copies for. So that's, you know, it's different, different kind of thing. So I don't know.
Yeah, I think most of authors these days, they get approached like I get approached about anthologies. Like somebody sending you a random Facebook message, oh, hey, I'm doing an anthology. And just give me your work and...
No, I don't like that at all. I don't like that at all, and I would never pay to be in an anthology. I know some people do that or anything like that. No, I don't like that at all. I do think people should be paid for their work, or if the work's going to a charity, that's okay too. But, you know, we're trying to pay. We haven't made any money yet on Sins of the Past. But once we've made money on Sins of the Past, we do want to pay the authors, you know, and that was the idea that you either give the money to charity or you pay the authors. You don't keep the money.
Right.
That we don't do, you know?
Well, I'm glad to hear that. But so can you run down all the books and stories we've talked about so far in this episode?
Okay, I can try.
That you've written.
Okay, so my two novels. You know what? Let me just bring up on here my Amazon page. That's the easiest way to do this, isn't it? But okay, so my two novels are Pores and Argentum, and they both were released by Rocking Horse Publishing and available, and are available through Amazon or Barnes & Noble, Books A Million, whatever you want. You can, in fact, if you go into a store and order, or any indie bookstore, if you go into a store and order a book, they'll get it for you, and then they'll maybe they'll put some more on the shelf. That's true of any indie author. If you actually want want something and you don't want to buy it from Amazon, you'd like to buy it from your local Barnes & Noble or local bookstore, go into the bookstore and ask them. If it's on their website, they'll get it for you, and they might buy a few more and put it on the shelf. So you're helping an indie author that way.
Okay.
So that's Pores and Argentum. The main anthology we talked about was Sins of the Past. Also available on Amazon. In all of these things are available both in paperback or ebook. Kindle on Sins is $3.99, the same on Pores and Argentum, all $3.99 for all of those on Kindle and whatever the different prices for the paperbacks. Other anthologies I'm part of, Shades of Fear has my cancer story in it called The Big C, and a lot of other very good, some horror, some speculative, some fantasy, some other real-life stories, people's real-life stories. It's a big mix of different high-quality stories in Shades of Fear. Heroes and Villains from the Fiction Writers Group. My Alistair story, which is the background for my villain in Pores, is in that one. For Apocalypse, it was an idea originally of Misha Bemet, and I'll let him talk about that more next week, because I'm sure he will. What else did we mention? Darkly Never After is another charity anthology. I have a story called Remora in there. That's all dark fairy tales. And, you know, I think that might be all that we talked about today.
Okay. Well, it sounds great.
And
so
you
can thank
look,
you for being
look
my
me
guest.
Up on Amazon if you want. Thank you. Thank
yes.
you for having me. I'm very happy to talk to you.
It is very
I hope
great.
Everybody
Friends
enjoyed the story.
Well. Mm-hmm. Yes, you were excellent. You read very well
Thank
as
you.
Well. And the story was great, very mm-hmm. interesting and unique, dynamic. Will mm-hmm. you come back and read to us again at a later date?
I would certainly love to do that. If you would like, I'll read Alistair, because that's horror too.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay. Sounds great. Well, until then,
right.
you have a good night.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Deirdre. Good night to you. All right.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
Okay, so Debbie has already told us about Misha coming on the show. He's going to bring us a little controversy next week on Outskirts Science Fiction Theater. That will be next Saturday on February 7th at 9 p.m. Eastern, so listen to Misha Barnett then. Tomorrow, Sunday, February 1st at 5:30 p.m. Eastern, the Bonafide Literary Show is back as I kick off a brand new season with my first erotica guest on this entire Avid Reader Nation, Deborah Shade. You may have heard Deborah Shade on a previous episode of the Book Tea, but if you haven't, definitely check her out before she drops in on the Bonafide Literary Show for this very special episode of Diverse Authors and Books as Deborah gives us a old nasty read. Don't forget to hop over to www.bonafideliteraryshow.com to book an episode of the show or check out the authors. Thursday, February 5th at 3 p.m. Eastern, Steve Wilson is going to spill on his guidebook on dating with me on the Book Tea. Follow Avid Reader Nation not to miss a thing this upcoming week and every week thereafter. You can follow all the Avid Reader Nation shows on the network page here on blogtalkradio.com or hit subscribe on the iTunes or Stitcher apps or any place else you are listening to us. To reach out to any Avid Reader Nation shows, hit up avidreadernation@gmail.com. I am Deidre Huey, the host of Outskirts Science Fiction Theater. Until you hear from me again, visit LaDramaPrincess.com, but only if you're over 18.